And reconvene, we just came from closed session, and I believe we have no report. Correct.
City Attorney, no report.
Okay. So there's no report, and we will move to our regular session, and Councilmember Kelly will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Please repeat after me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Councilmember Kelly. And I guess I should welcome you also to the City Council meeting. I failed to do that. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Kelly.
Here.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie.
Here.
Mayor Barrow.
Here.
All present.
Next item is approval of the agenda. Motion, please.
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie, seconded by Councilmember O'Malley. Roll call, please.
Councilmember O'Malley?
Yes.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor Barrow?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Next item is our consent calendar, and tonight we only have five items, which is not too bad. First one is City Council draft minutes from July 14th. Second is adoption of an updated purchasing policy. Third is the June 2009 accounts payable and payroll. Number four is the zone text change amendment for West Front Village. And number five is the annual street striping award. Anybody on the council want to pull an item? I'm going to be pulling item four to vote no. Anyone from the public want to pull an item? Seeing no one, I'll take a motion for the rest.
Move approval of remaining consent calendar items.
Second.
Motion by Councilmember O'Malley to approve 1, 2, 3, and 5, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie. Roll call, please.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Yes.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie.
Yes.
Mayor Barrow.
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Move approval of number 4 on the consent calendar.
Second.
Second.
Motion to approve item number 4, which is zone text change for amendment for West Front Village, and seconded by Councilmember Fonzie. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Councilmember O'Malley?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor Barrow?
No.
4-1, motion passes.
We move to the updates from the city manager. Mr. McKinney?
Mayor and Council, I'm very excited to tell you that we have discussed with all the parties of Colony Square this week and last. All of the agreements are in place and the funding is in place. They're working on final documents. We expect to have signatures on those documents in the coming weeks. We still believe that a groundbreaking in October is possible, and anticipate finaling all of the documents as soon as possible. We have an update about lake water quality from our Public Works Director, Russ Thompson, and an update on the Las Lomas Assessment District issues that we had been discussing.
Yes, Council. Good evening. I wanted to update you on the lake water quality. As we all know that the lake is kind of in a little bit of rough shape with the water level being so low with the drought conditions we've been having. And normally this time of the year, we have the water heats up and we have algae blooms. And so the dissolved oxygen content is always a concern each summer. To that end, we had our biological consultant, Althaus and Mead, go out and look, kind of review what we were doing as far as monitoring and what we were doing, our plans in place for addressing water quality issues and oxygen levels in the lake. And their report basically confirmed that what we were doing by having standby pumps and then as we did a year or two ago, the rain for rent, additional pumping, additional spraying and circulating of the water was in fact about all we can reasonably do with the constraints on us. So I think it was a good confirmation that the plan we have is appropriate and it should be effective in helping the water quality. And so we continue to be in kind of a standby mode. We monitor the dissolved oxygen content each day, and so far we've lucked out with the amount of wind and breeze that we've had in the afternoons help keep the oxygen level up. So we continue to monitor the situation, and we're ready with the standby pumping. And that's really just...
I have one quick question. I know you have that satellite-looking thing that turns the water. Does that seem to be working well?
I think it is effective. The little solar bee, mm-hmm. Little aerator unit, I think it's effective. I think we could use, you know, several more.
Because that was a pilot kind of a approach.
Yeah, I think that does help. But if the lake surface area is so large and the depth is so reduced now that it's hard to keep enough air going into the water. So it's a challenge. Until the water level comes up, we're going to continue to have to be kind of in a standby mode.
Well, my son is still fishing there, and he's still catching things, so yeah. It can't be too bad.
Yeah, we haven't had any fish kill or fish, you know, okay. problems so far, but we continue to monitor it.
So will Althaus and Mead also make recommendations if we need to supplement the one mixer we have with more in the future?
We could ask them. That was not part of their recommendation. Their okay. recommendation was just be ready with the standby pumps.
Okay, thank you.
Then also on the Las Lomas Benefit Assessment District, we were having a few complaints about maintenance out there. We met with the owners of the community, the neighborhood out there. We had a pretty good attended meeting. There's, I would say, about 30 residents showed up, and we discussed what we were doing, and heard what their concerns were. The timing was good because we're putting the landscape maintenance contract back out to bid, and so we were able to take some of their comments and incorporate them into the expectations expressed in the RFP for the contract services. So we should be getting those bids back in about a month, and I think we're on the right track. We've stepped up our oversight of the contractor and done some assessments both on the irrigation system and the number of plants out there, and I think we're back on the right track with them, and I think in the next month should show the results of that.
Thank you. Mr. McKinney, is there anything else?
No. I have a question for Wayne.
Okay, go
just
ahead.
In layman's language on Colony Square, everything has been verbally committed to, and it's just a matter now of getting everything signed and the financing in place and moving forward?
Yes, that's correct. The bank loans are in place. The partners have funded the remainder of the project. They have an agreement with the theater owner. The deal points are all agreed to. We've talked to both parties. Everybody's agreed. And so now they're wrapping up those documents that will be the final financing and final lease agreements.
Thank you.
And Mr. McKinney, I believe there's some rumors about Walmart. Can you clarify what we know?
Certainly. We do not have a new application submitted from Walmart. We anticipate hearing from them but have not. As we understand it, the vice presidents in Arkansas need to authorize the go-ahead of the Atascadero project, and they have yet to do that. We anticipate that, and of course, like others, have heard rumors of a smaller store. But I talked with Aaron Rios of Walmart last Friday, and he said that they're working on it in Arkansas. And as soon as he heard something, we would hear.
Okay, thank you. And I believe we need to do a microphone check, from what I understand. I'm not sure how we do that.
Councilmember O'Malley, if you want to just check your mic, please.
Good evening. 1, 2, 3. We're all here.
Turn it down a little bit.
It's, they can't hear me. I think it's deliberate.
Who fixed that?
Can you hear me now?
It sounded better to me. You're not. You're kind of far away.
Needs to go up a little bit. Yeah.
1, 2, 3.
So are we done?
Steve, can you hear me? Can you read my lips? Looks like
okay, well, let's continue on, and next time you talk, okay. They can always adjust it as we go. Okay, so the next item is community forum, and this portion of the meeting is reserved for persons wanting to talk on any subject that's not on our agenda tonight. Everyone has 3 minutes, and please state your name for the record. And you may begin.
My name is Pastor Tom Farrell from Atascadero Bible Church. It's comforting to know that there are microphones outside of our church that actually don't work. So on a Sunday morning, it seems to always happen to us. So I'd like to just direct us in prayer and on behalf of the Atascadero Ministerial Association. So if you could bow our heads in prayer. Heavenly Father, today we come to you and we just again ask that you might give direction and wisdom to this city and this community that we live in. Lord, we live in days that are unlike many days that we've experienced before. God, there are many who are seeking employment and many businesses that are truly struggling in this community. And Lord, we would just ask that you would cause there to be prosperity that would come to the businesses and that there would be jobs that would be created for those who are looking for employment. And God, that you would make a real way of provision for us. Give our council wisdom, Lord, as they make decisions that will impact those various areas as well. Lord, we thank you for this nation that we live in, and we just pray for our nation as well. And so we commit this evening to you, in Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good evening. Lee Perkins from Atascadero. Back to the Atascadero Lake. I walk around the lake at least once a week. Last week I was walking for no apparent reason. Two older gentlemen passed me, pointed to the lake, and said, "Isn't this terrible?" I agreed and told them to let their city council know of their dissatisfaction. I read the brief article in the TT on August 31st, and I've heard what you're doing. You're monitoring the lake. My first question would be, why just monitor? Because it's really looking terrible. The city has two gems, the city hall and the lake. Both are prominently pictured in the city brochures. How disappointing for tourists who visit the city and see the city hall boarded up and the lake receding and brown. I know more stimulus money will be coming to localities for shovel-ready programs. Second question is, are there any plans to save Atascadero Lake with shovel-ready renovations to take preventative measures so we don't have a brown lake every summer, weed out non-indigenous plants, and prune trees? On another note, you have seen me up here a number of times in the last 2 years asking when the council or city is going to make the owner of the printery, Mr. Gerhardt, at least mothball it for its own safekeeping. I was shocked to read in a TT article that the city of Atascadero, after losing hundreds of thousands of dollars of revenue from stalled building projects started by Kelly Gerhardt, has now agreed to help Gerhardt out and pay $30,000 to $60,000 in upfront costs for mothballing the historic printery. My question is, why is the city helping Kelly Gerhardt out? He has serious charges against him of fraud and Ponzi schemes. The TT article mentions a possible payback compensation when the printery property is eventually sold. But in a later article in the TT on September 9th, Gerhardt's creditors are lining up with Gerhardt listing $45 million in debt and only $6.4 million in assets. It is highly unlikely the city will recoup the cost of the repairs to mothball the printery. And it is the taxpayers of the city of Atascadero that are footing this bill. This is not okay. These are difficult times for all cities in California. Here in Atascadero, we have had layoffs, and next year doesn't look much better. How can the city afford to mothball a building it doesn't own? Thank you.
Welcome.
Good evening. Richard Mullen from Atascadero on Portola Road. I, too, am here to speak about the color of our lake. I think the gentleman said that they were monitoring it and things were going as good as could be expected with the monitoring that's going on, what we have in there. If it's being monitored and year after year it's still turning this color, maybe we need to do something a little bit more drastic. Maybe it's time to drain the lake, dredge it, and put in a good aeration system. I don't go over there anymore just because I don't want to look at that lake that looks, well, my shirt looks a lot nicer than that lake does. But I think it's time that we stop, you know, putting Band-Aid approaches on it. If we're serious about maintaining that lake, let's clean it up. Let's go ahead and put in a good aeration or filtration system, whatever is necessary to keep a live lake going on a year-round basis. Thank you.
Good evening, Council. My name is David Broadwater. I'm here tonight because, as you may remember, at the last City Council meeting when there was a discussion about campaign finance reform, there was an accusation made against me as the author of an email which was circulated by a local organization that I was involved in character assassination against three sitting members of this council. I'm here to stand to tell you that looking at a copy of that email that was circulated, those allegations are completely false. The statements in the report that I gave about campaign contributions that had been received by three sitting members of this city council were factual. My recounting of the circumstances that led to the consequence of members of the public and people attending meetings not being aware of those contributions were factual. And my report that this council refused to apply the same legal and ethical standard that applies to commissioners, Parks and Recreation and Planning Commission, to declare on the record when an applicant stands before you that's given you more than $250 in contributions, that you declare that during the meeting, that this council turned down the opportunity to require itself to be as honest about those things as members of the commissions that you appoint. I think it's very serious when a sitting member of the council launches accusations at a member of the public who has merely reported facts, things that happened, and what their consequences were in terms of what the public is able to find out about contributions. I said nothing about the intent or the motives of any of the individuals. I cited them as examples of why we needed some kind of reform and more transparency than we have, and this city council has been willing to consider. So to turn this factual reporting into an accusation against a member of the public who is merely reporting the facts as character assassination is conduct unbecoming of a member of this council. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm Grinda Ernst, and I'm here representing the Friends of the Library. I'd like to update you on what's happening with our capital campaign to expand the library. The Board of Supervisors for the county has pledged to provide us with $3 million, and we are to come up with the other half. As I told you last time I was here, we already have $1 million, so we're working on the other two. But we do have the pledge from the county. We'll be signing the MOU with the county in 2 weeks, and by we, I mean the Friends of the Library. So that's very exciting news for us. We're very pleased with the momentum and with the cooperation that the county's providing. They're anxious for the library to be expanded, and they're offering us all help. We've also just hired an architect for the project, and he's Greg Ravat, who lives locally, has an investment in the community, is active in the community, is very excited about the project, and we're very pleased to have him working with us. And then finally, I wanted to tell you about an upcoming fundraiser event, which I think will be quite a gala, a lot of fun, and a very interesting one. We have 27 local artists in the community who are volunteering their time and their artistic talent to paint children's chairs. And these chairs will be displayed throughout the county in the next several weeks. And then we're going to auction them on October 24th at a gala that we're calling the Art of Charity, chair as in C-H-A-I-R. And we think this is going to be a super event. It's going to be held at the Red Tree Gallery. In all of the things that we've been doing, we've made every effort to keep our fundraising here locally. The Red Tree Gallery is opening their doors and their back parking lot to us. And so we would be delighted if we would have a wide attendance. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Good evening, Council. I'm Steve Martin, and the hat I'm wearing tonight is that of the chairman of the Colony Days Committee. And amidst all the other things happening in the community, we may forget that Colony Days, the annual celebration, is just a little more than a month away now, October 17th. And this year we have some pretty significant improvements coming along. We're working with the city and other officials to slightly change the parade route to avoid closing freeway off-ramps. That's going to reduce our expenses and will not change the length of the parade, but will give people many more opportunities to see the parade through the downtown. The theme of the parade this year is Strike Up the Band, and we are working with the Atascadero Greyhound Athletic Foundation to bring in bands from outside of the area. We have all of our local bands, of course. We have bands from other high schools in the county coming in, and we have bands from outside of the area, including a two-time national award-winning band, the Inglewood High School Band, will be marching the parade this year. After the parade, there'll be a drumline competition, and then about 1:30, 2 o'clock up at the high school, there will be a field show competition, so that's going to add to the Colony Days festivities this year. All of the information about Colony Days, the parade route, Tent City, the Historical Society will be involved with Tent City this year to sort of expand that activity. That's all available at colonydays.com, as are application forms for vendors, parade entries, et cetera. Parade entry forms are also available at the Main Street office, the Chamber office, and Atascadero City Hall. So we're looking forward to October 17th and a great Colony Day celebration. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no one else approach the podium, I'll go ahead and close community forum. And we move on to public hearings, which there are none tonight. And then we move on to item C, which is management reports. And the first one is the fee waiver request for Atascadero Lake Park special event, the Veterans Foundation Poker Run. And I believe Councilmember Fonzie has a statement.
Usually you answer questions that were asked during.
Oh, thank you. Sorry. Mr. McKinney, do you have any answers for any of the questions that were posed by the public tonight? I've skipped over that.
Not additional answers other than the lake.
Russ, do you have any comments about? There were some concerns about the lake water quality, and do you have anything you want to add to that?
I think the only thing that I didn't mention earlier was that in past years, we were able to get water from the water company to add and supplement to the lake. Not that it, you know, increased the depth significantly, but I think it helped. But in this, in these drought conditions that we're experiencing this year and all the other water cutbacks and conservation measures they've implemented, we were not able to get any excess water or water from them. So that's been another challenge this year as opposed to previous years.
And sure, go ahead, Councilmember.
Is the shallow well pumping, Russ, that's south end?
Yes.
Does it pump?
I think the sustained amount of water we get out of that well is maybe 50 to 75 gallons a minute. On a good day, it might keep up with evaporation in the lake, and it's not going to increase the level of the lake.
But does that maintain for 24 hours, or do you run it for 8, or what do you run it?
I don't know exactly. I don't think we run it 24 hours a day. I don't think it can sustain that that type. It's got to rest somewhat.
You know, just we call it a lake, but folks, it's really a pond. And you know, this has been going on. I've been here since 1940, and we get the low years, and believe me, the lake was just as. I used to swim in it, and the moss would hang all over your shoulders and everything else. And so, this is nothing new. And we're fortunate that we have the city, you know, that's willing to deal with it. In those days, there was no city, and whatever happened, happened. But keep up the good work.
Mr. McKinney, did you want to add?
I'm sorry. In addition, I just wanted to point out, with respect to the printery, as been reported in the newspaper, we are looking for the ability to mothball the building and how that would occur. The city council has not directed us to mothball the building. We're not spending any money on an actual mothballing program at this time. We're trying to figure out what those legal authorities are. We recognize that that's an important building, and we want to give you as much information and opportunity to deal with that historic resource as possible. So there is no authorization for you to give money to Mr. Gearhart or to mothball the building at this time.
Okay.
I have another question for Wade. Wade, it's been reported in the paper that the city owes Kelly Gearhart money in regards to sewer lines. Could you give us a rundown on how that really works?
I'd be glad to have the city attorney give you that
rundown.
Thank you.
We received a correspondence from Mr. Gibson, who's the attorney for the trustee in the Gerhardt bankruptcy action, inquiring as to what the status was on payments that might be due to Mr. Gerhardt regarding some of these reimbursement agreements. Those reimbursement agreements would apply when, for example, Mr. Gerhardt would put in a sewer line that might benefit other properties, and then he would be reimbursed a certain dollar amount if that should happen. And following our review of the six projects, we found that the city did not owe any amount to Mr. Gerhardt.
So, in other words, no one has hooked up to the city sewers, and we haven't had to reimburse Kelly Gerhardt for anything.
There were some connections that were made, and he was paid for those connections that were made.
In the past.
In the past, as would any the developer have been entitled to. But the question was, the question raised was whether or not there was any amount currently due to Mr. Gerhardt, and the answer to that is no.
Thank you.
And then, Mr. McKinney, I don't want to belabor the point, but I was told at one time the council had authorized to install some aeration system that didn't work. Do you know anything about that?
I think I know what you're talking about. I'm not really sure. There was an aeration system in the Atascadero Lake for quite some time. It was a pump under the pavilion that pumped. There was airlines at the bottom of the lake and pumped air out or through, and then bubbles came up. It wasn't maintained through the early 90s, and really in the late 90s, it wasn't really operable. There was very little of the line left, and we took the system out, and then we put in, at the council direction, the Solar B, which is the system that's currently providing that the aeration to the lake. But those are the only two I'm aware of.
Okay. I just knew there was a little more history that we could discuss. Okay. I think I covered it all. Thank you, Councilmember Clay, for reminding me to address those community concerns. So we're back to C1, and Councilmember Fonzie wanted to make a statement.
Okay. This item is regarding the Atascadero Veterans Memorial Foundation, and in order to avoid any appearance of impropriety, I'm excusing myself from voting on this item because I'm on the board of directors for the Veterans Memorial Foundation. Although I have no financial interest in the outcome and the organization is a nonprofit group, I'm aware that in the past city council members have been criticized for voting on items that affect organizations in which they are members or their spouses were members. Therefore, I will not be voting on this item, although I will remain in my seat here.
Okay, so who gives the report? Mr. McKinney?
I'm sorry, Mr. Cherry.
I have a question
Mr.
about
Cherry.
Stepping down.
Okay,
Brian, do
go
we
ahead.
Have to be remove ourselves if we step down, Brian?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Cherry.
Thank you, Mayor Bayrou, members of the City Council. This evening, we are entertaining a request by the Veterans Memorial Foundation for a fee waiver for the use of Atascadero Lake Park for a special event which entails a fundraiser for the memorial. The summary recommendation is that the city staff is recommending that the fee waiver be denied this evening due to the absence of special circumstances that would create an exception to our existing fees and the precedent that would be created for other groups that would want similar fee waivers for their worthy causes. And so we would like to recommend that the fee waiver be denied for the following reasons. The community impact fee waivers of this type would obviously benefit individual groups that normally pay such fees, and we have many, by the way. However, similar fee waivers in the future could result in the loss of potentially thousands of dollars annually in park and facility use fees, and less revenue results in less money and funds to maintain our city parks and facilities. A little bit of background on this. The Veterans Foundation has built the beautiful Faces of Freedom Memorial at Atascadero Lake Park. As everyone knows, this unique and powerful memorial represents nearly $1 million in funds raised, donated, and in-kind services. The foundation uses fundraisers such as the upcoming poker run to be held this Saturday, September 12th, to help maintain and improve the memorial for the city and the community. The foundation has applied to use the Lake Park for its second annual poker run on the 12th, and they have requested that the special event fee for nonprofit groups, which is $500, be waived. The event will include a barbecue, a motorcycle ride, live band, and a raffle, among other things. And I wanted to tell you a little bit of background on our fee structure. As some of you may know, I know Councilman Clay will remember, in 2002, the council adopted a cost allocation study which identified the true costs of all of our activities, such as parks and facility rentals. The study formed the basis of the City Council adopted fee structure, which we have, which reflects subsidized nonprofit rates for community services organizations like the foundation. In other words, we looked at all of our fees. We have separate classifications of fees for private for-profit groups, for resident groups, non-resident groups, for nonprofit groups, and so on. And so our fee structure already recognizes that we want to subsidize our community groups like our service clubs and organizations like the foundation. So the fees charged to groups like the foundation are already subsidized, and they receive discount rates in recognition of the valuable service they provide our community. Now, a little bit of background on the poker run in this particular event. Last year was the first year in 2008, and the foundation was granted a fee waiver due to the fact that the organization was up against a time deadline to get the memorial built. I remember talking to Mrs. Hatch about the foundation needing to get their names in to the company that was going to engrave the names in the granite wall. They weren't even sure with this first-time event, you know, how much money they were going to raise. And obviously there was some risk in this event in putting it on because they had their costs. And we wanted to see this memorial completed on time. And I want to emphasize that the City of Atascadero has been a partner, a cooperative partner with the foundation since this effort was undertaken. And we obviously do own the memorial. It's on city property. So we did everything we can in terms of the staff trying to work with the foundation to make sure that their fundraiser was successful. So for the last year, for their first ever, we did waive the fee because we wanted to make sure that that project got built and they could dedicate it and have the ribbon cutting this last year. Now, regarding the policy, like the foundation, we have many groups and organizations in Atascadero that directly benefit the city and city facilities. And I can guarantee you I've had this conversation about fees with just about every nonprofit group in the city, because virtually every group would like to have their facility fees waived for the parks or the pavilion and so forth. And I've told them we simply are unable to do that. And examples of some of these other groups that are similar to the foundation, take the Zoological Society of the Central Coast. Their whole mission and their whole purpose is to raise funds for the Charles Paddock Zoo. All they do is raise funds for the benefit of the zoo. It's city-owned property, just as the memorial is. And they've had many fundraisers, and we require them to pay fees. The Board of Realtors over the years have raised thousands of dollars for the city and donated that money to the city's parks and the zoo. If you think of the Atascadero Firefighters Association, they used to use the pavilion for free because when they first started having the fireman's ball, it was at the armory. The city actually requested that they move the event to the pavilion when the pavilion first opened in 92, and the Firefighters Association did not pay fees. Recently, we have asked them to pay fees, and they now pay fees, even though all the money they raise goes right back into the fire department for equipment and things for our city fire department. If you take the Rotary Club, they donated $50,000 up front in 92 to build the pavilion. Over the years, they've donated many thousands of dollars to the city, not only for the pavilion, but for the parks. If you think of all the lights that are in a lake park, the aqua-colored lights throughout the park, they were donated by the Rotary Club. They donated recently, about 2 years ago, the shade structure over Group Area 1, the barbecue area. Kiwanis has done the same thing. I could go on, Quota Club, you know the work they've done in the pavilion and the donations they've made there. So all of these groups have many, many years of history of donating funds to the city for our city facilities, much like the foundation has done. All of these groups are paying fees, and that's why we want to make sure we're consistent. Who gets fee waivers now? Co-sponsored groups do not pay fees, or other governmental agencies in the performance of their duties that are related to a concern of a significant number of Atascadero residents or a problem. We don't charge fees for polling places, for elections, that type of thing, public forums. We obviously charge fees if they're political in nature. If an assemblyman, for example, is having a political fundraiser, we charge them for that. But if they're here and they're going to provide a service to our citizens and have an informational forum, we wouldn't charge them for something like that. We also co-sponsor city retirement functions like the retirement of Chief John Couch, who retired recently, or one of our firefighters recently retired with 35 years of service. We just passed on some of the pass-through fees, like the cleaning fees, for those types of co-sponsored events. Also, groups like Main Street and the Chamber of Commerce that have formal relationships with the city to perform events and activities for community benefit. An example would be like when the Chamber conducts something like the economic forecast. We co-sponsor that with them. If you take Winter Wonderland, the use of the Sunken Gardens for Main Street, we co-sponsor that. And we contract with those agencies or those organizations to do precisely those kinds of events for the city. Some other considerations is obviously fairness and policy consistency. I think citizens and community groups need to know that when they come and they deal with the city, that we're going to treat them just like all the other community groups, and all that I'm going to treat my neighbor the same way I do anybody else. And so we try to apply all these policies fairly and without favor. And believe me, it's not easy sometimes, because not all of these circumstances are all the same. Most nonprofits providing community service in the city have worthy causes. I think we're all aware of that, that benefit the city. Unfortunately, we cannot waive everybody's fees as much as I'd like to. It sure make my job a lot easier if I could just tell everybody yes, instead of sitting down with groups I see like Mrs. Ernst here tonight and explaining why, you know, we need to implement fees for the Friends of the Library for their fundraiser and things like that. And as I say, I've had these conversations with virtually every community group in town. We need to uphold our fees because we actually need the revenue. And if you think about opening this up, for example, if the council was to grant this fee waiver request this evening, where would we draw the line? In other words, then the foundation might decide they want to have more than one fundraiser a year at the Lake Park. Do we waive those fees? If they want to use the pavilion, do we end up waiving those fees? And, you know, then where do we draw the line when we start waiving fees? I can tell you I've had a couple of conversations with a couple of community groups out there that are watching this, and they've told me if the council approves this fee waiver tonight, they're going to be next in line. They're going to be down here and asking for the same type of fee waiver. So we have to be very, very careful in applying this kind of waiver, and that we are fair and consistent in our implementation of the policies. Conclusion: nobody likes fees. I think I can say that with all confidence, and I think all of you probably heard the same thing. However, the city needs fair and consistency policy implementation, and that's why we're here tonight recommending that we not waive these fees. Nonprofit groups already receive a rate break in our policies and our fee structure because we do recognize their community service to the community. And fee waivers must be handled judiciously, as they'll be scrutinized and set a precedent for future groups and as we move along into the future. Staff recommends denial of the Veterans Foundation request, but I like to close by saying this recommendation in no way reflects anything about the efforts of the foundation. In fact, we have a very cooperative partnership with the foundation. We work together with them for the benefit of the city and the memorial to improve it and maintain it and make sure that everything is successful as we can make it, including this event coming up on the 12th. So that concludes my report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you for that report, Brady. I think we're very fortunate to live in a community who has so many nonprofits that do good work for us and also benefits the city. My question about the fees, I believe the fees are meant to cover our costs and it's never to create any kind of profit source for the city itself. Could you just speak to that briefly?
Yes. In the 2002 cost allocation study that was performed for us, we legally actually can't make a profit on our fees, and particularly the nonprofit fees that are charged to community groups are definitely subsidized. We don't make anything on it. When I think about the amount of staff time that goes into a lot of these special events and supporting them from the time someone brings an application to the front counter in City Hall and all of the different departments that touch it and our coordination and right down to our park staff that helps out on the day of the event, those types of things, they in no way recover our costs. And by the way, I wanted to mention Mr. Chuck Ward is here from the foundation to represent them.
Councilmember Clay, you have a question?
Yes. So ordinarily the fee would be $750, is that it?
Yes. Well, for this particular event, it would be $500 because the foundation is a nonprofit. But if you and I, Councilman Clay, were going to hold a barbecue out there for a family member, we would pay $750.
Okay, so the regular rate for anybody but nonprofits is $750.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Create a firestorm here, but I think this is a reasonable and rational request, and I'll give you my ideas on it. As it was mentioned, the fee was waived last year. So I'm the guy, among other things, that's organizing this event, so we put our budget together and we assumed that the city would recognize the benefit of this and would waive it again. Now, the staff has raised some interesting points here, and I'd like to counter those. This is not just another building. This isn't a firehouse. This isn't a zoo. No city funds went into this memorial. 100% of the funds, or close to it, was raised from events like this. This is a very unique situation. And I don't think that waiving the fee for this is going to create a stampede of every single nonprofit. Because when a zoological society raises fees for the zoo, this is a facility that this city has spent hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars on. When the Veterans Memorial Foundation raises funds, 100% of it goes to the maintenance and capital improvements of a facility that the city owns. Now, there's an effect of this. You say that the effect is going to be a stampede of every nonprofit demanding that they have their fees waived. Well, I'm not too sure of that. But I will say this, there'll be a reaction to the dozens and dozens of people that we solicited, from Thai restaurants to car washers that donated $25 here, $30 there. And those that are watching this tonight are going to say, all those gift certificates and money that we gave is going to pay a fee so that we can have the privilege of using the park to raise money to give back to the city. Some may say this is perhaps disingenuous. I wouldn't go so far as to say that. But I think this is a unique situation. It is not just check the box here. So I would ask you members of the city council to think about that this facility is not just a memorial and a group of concrete and black granite in this city. This is a memorial that is going to be recognized throughout the country because it's part and centerfold of the new Purple Heart Trail that is part of the national network of monuments like this all over the nation. We're expecting about 700 people to come to this poker run. There's going to be several hundred coming here that have never visited the city of Atascadero. So this is a wonderful opportunity to showcase this marvelous city and this great marge to the memorial. So our total operating budget comes from events like this. They come from brick sales, and they come from one annual big event. It would be a real boost to all the people that have worked so hard to put this memorial together, and I'm not including myself, for the city to show that they truly are a partner in this by waiving this fee. And I think that to do so would set a wonderful precedent that you support the veterans of this community. One in every four households in this county, there's a veteran. This county has the highest percentage of veteran households of any county in the nation, and this is the memorial that was built to honor all those veterans. So thank you very much, and I hope you will seriously consider our waiver. And if anyone has any question, I'll be very happy to answer it.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. I don't see any lights. Mr. Clay.
Chuck, in regards to your budget, though, the city doesn't have any say over your budget or how you budget your money, so to speak, right?
The question is, does the city have any say on our budget?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know if the city should have a say as to whether or not we write a check for AmVet to support that wonderful amputee group, or whether the city should have a say as to whether we support Kathy Baker's arbiter, or down the road whether we support any other veteran organizations. We make those decisions internally because we've raised all the money. I think if the city forked up a lot of money for this, then I think the city could have a say in our budget.
Well, I just wanted to point out that you were separate from the city in regards to the foundation.
Yes.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, Councilmember Kelly.
Any other questions?
Yes, Councilmember Kelly.
I don't have any questions, but a comment.
Okay, sure.
Anybody have a question for Chuck before he sits down?
And thank you for giving me the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chuck. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So before Councilmember Kelly gets to that, does anybody else want to speak on this item? Because this is public comment time.
Eric Estelle from Tascadero. I can appreciate Brady's point of view on this, but as a former veteran, I'm willing to pay the fee for the foundation, but I'm also accepting anybody to step up and help me pay the fee. That way everybody's happy. The fee gets paid.
I'll kick in $100, okay?
I'll go across the street before the end of the meeting. We'll get taken care of. That way everybody should be happy.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
My name is David Bentz. I live in 3F Meadows. I know the city has a $48 million budget total, $20 million in the general fund. I could throw a dart at that budget, and wherever it landed, I could find the $500, and you wouldn't miss it. There isn't an organization in this city that is better deserving of this support than this organization today.
At some point in time, it'll be highly recognized throughout the whole United States. We have the Purple Highway that is going to be part of it. As Mr. Ward stated, there will be 700 people in town that weekend. I'm sure the city will be making some money off of these people. I'm a veteran, not a combat veteran or anything like that. I've had friends who are veterans, and I have friends who have their names on walls in other places. And I would actually be ashamed if this city didn't waive this fee, at least for this one time, so that the organization can complete their project and help our city with tourism, but most of all, to honor our fallen comrades. So I'm in favor of waiving the fee. I appreciate the gentleman coming up and volunteering to do that, but I don't think this city should accept his offer, and that it's our responsibility to do that.
Make a motion.
I make a motion that we waive the fee for the Veterans Foundation.
I'll second.
Discussion. I just want to say I support staff's position on this. I think it's very difficult to try to make decisions on a staff level on who deserves and who doesn't deserve and who deserves a waiver. And I think it's important that we make it very clear for staff what the council's wishes are. I think if we grant a waiver, and we've already had a request to pay the fee, if we grant a waiver, it muddies that line, and I think it makes it more difficult. I agree we have great nonprofits in this town, and I think, you know, any work people are doing to promote our town is a wonderful thing, but I think precedence is more important. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Councilmember Clay?
I'd like to discuss a little further because Tom said he's willing to put up 100. I'm willing to put up 100, and maybe we can do it that way. So I'm going to withdraw my second, see if we can muster up $500 out of this crowd.
It sounds like we do. He already said he was going to pay for it. So does that mean we can just drop the issue?
That'd be fine by me. I think some of our staff members are also willing to kick in, so If the council members like to withdraw our motion, I'm sure we can find the fee.
I'll withdraw the motion, and I'll kick in 100 also.
Why don't we just say that whoever contributes, certainly willing, but the city staff and council will cover the fee because I think it's important to keep the precedent, but we certainly acknowledge this organization. I would prefer to do that.
I'm okay with that.
City attorney, is there anything we need to do procedurally?
What I'm hearing is that the fee is not being waived. So,
correct.
In the absence of your waiving the fee would still apply.
Okay. So does there need to be a motion, or can we just move to the next item?
You can move to the next item.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, thank you, everyone. We're doing great on time here. Okay, we'll move to item C2, which is report on interim urgency ordinance establishing a temporary moratorium on the establishment and operation of a medical marijuana facilities. And I believe our city attorney will be giving that report.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. The proposed, too close to the mic, the proposed interim urgency ordinance would place a temporary 45-day moratorium on medical marijuana. In 2001, the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative, held that the Federal Controlled Substances Act continued to prohibit marijuana use, distribution, and possession, and that there was no medical necessity exception under the federal law. That was reaffirmed by the Supreme Court in a 2005 decision of Gonzalez versus Reich. So currently there is a conflict in the law between federal law and state law with respect to the operation of medical marijuana facilities for medicinal purposes. In addition to the conflict between federal and state law, there have also been a number of communities that have reported law enforcement issues which have arisen in connection with such facilities, including illegal drug activity, illegal drug sales, robbery of persons leaving dispensaries, loitering around dispensaries, falsely obtaining identification cards to qualify for medical marijuana, as well as increases in other criminal activity. Due to the conflict between the state law and the federal law on this issue, and because of the potential negative effects from a law enforcement standpoint that follow the establishment of such medical marijuana facilities, it is recommended that the council adopt the urgency ordinance. It is a moratorium. It would prevent the approval of a medical marijuana facility within the city for a period of 45 days. At the end of that 45 days, this matter would be returned to you for a decision as to whether to extend the moratorium. The next extension period could potentially be for a period of 10 months and 15 days, and there would be a report submitted to you 10 days prior to that 45-day period describing what additional analysis there has been done by the staff in connection with such facilities. It would be necessary if the council is interested in approving this urgency ordinance that there be a 4/5 vote, otherwise it will not pass. I can respond, and the draft ordinance is, moratorium ordinance is in your packet, and I'm prepared to respond to any questions.
Brian, the city manager provided us with the Chapter 13 of our municipal code, I believe, and it mentions previous restrictions that the council has done regarding the location of medical marijuana dispensaries, and not everyone on the council was here at the time. Could you just review that briefly, what restrictions we had previously decided? And what locations of the city that means?
Yeah, I'll be glad to do that. I believe you're referring to Title 5, Chapter 13 of your municipal code. It's entitled Medical Marijuana Dispensaries. And this ordinance does allow for medical marijuana dispensaries to be opened in certain limited areas within the city and subject to a conditional use permit. The ordinance itself is some 13 pages long, so it's difficult for me to summarize it in detail other than to say that this current ordinance would allow medical marijuana dispensaries to be opened under certain conditions. And the moratorium prohibition, the city of Grover Beach has a prohibition, Arroyo Grande has a prohibition. It is permitted in the county of San Luis, subject to an approval of an appropriate permit. So at this point, there are no cities that allow medical marijuana dispensaries, and they are allowed in the county if you have the appropriate permit. And there's the moratorium in the city of San Luis Obispo. The only other city that would allow it is the Atascadero.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Clay, you have a question?
Yes, I wanted to go over a little background. I supported this in 2006 because for a number of reasons, but we had a dispensary here in Atascadero, right, Wade? And something happened, and the fellow left and went to Morro Bay, and then I understand he just got convicted in federal court. Is that right?
I assume you're referring to Charles Lynch, and, right. And my understanding is that he did have a medical. I was not your city attorney in 2006, right. But what I understand, there was a medical marijuana dispensary that was open for a short period of time. I think it was a matter of a month or two, and that closed because there were some issues with it. And then I believe that it was there was one that was open in Morro Bay.
Right, and then there was a federal intervention in the in his facility in Morro Bay somehow, and he ended up in federal court, and I believe he got it's under appeal now or something like that. So I guess my concern is federal law says one thing and state law says another, and we're in conflict here, and that bothers me. The other thing is the fact that all the other cities are denying this type of a situation, and we're the only one that isn't so far. So anyway, that's my comment.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Thank you. And some of this is, again, some clarifying review, because I believe I supported this in the past as well, and we had a previous council at the time, and I think we did the best we could with the information we had. Since then, it looks like there's additional court experience and law enforcement experience, and what you're suggesting is we take an opportunity to review and see if there should be any refinements to our ordinance. And apparently every other city in our county has come to a different conclusion than we had in the past. So you're just suggesting we're going to take some time to review and maybe consider other possibilities?
That's correct. That's what a moratorium does, is it's basically a timeout. Gives you an opportunity for a period of the first stage is the 45-day moratorium to evaluate it. And then, as I said earlier, I would return to you with a further report prior to the expiration of that 45-day moratorium. And at that point, you would have a number of options. You could allow the moratorium to expire, which would leave your current ordinance in effect. You could extend the moratorium, or you could consider an ordinance that prohibited medical marijuana facilities.
And you'll come back and give us more detail on our options after your review and within the 45 days.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Fonzie.
And when you bring us our report, will this be a public hearing so that the public will be able to weigh in on your...
The landscape is frequently changing, so whatever the latest information is that would be available, if there's anything that happens during the course of the next 45 days, I could report to you on that. I could also present to you a draft ordinance if you wanted to give me that direction this evening, which would give you as one option a prohibition on marijuana if you wanted to take that as a first reading, or if you're not prepared to give that direction tonight, we wait until the next time. You can extend the moratorium, give me direction to come back with a ordinance prohibiting dispensaries, or you could give me direction to extend the moratorium, or you could give me direction to allow the moratorium to expire and allow your current ordinance to remain in effect. So those are your options. It would be fully set forth in a report to you, and the public would be able to comment upon those options and present their opinions.
Thank you. And if I understood what you were saying about the other cities in the county, they have all put in either a moratorium or a prohibition, but the county of San Luis Obispo, in other words, unincorporated areas, are still able to have these dispensaries?
Yes, subject to the appropriate permit.
Thank you.
Councilmember Kelly.
Yes, do you have an opinion regarding the federal law superseding the state law, county law, and then our city law? I guess that if the federal law supersedes all of the other laws and we approved having one of these facilities in our town, would we actually be aiding and abetting somebody to commit a federal crime?
I do not have an opinion on whether or not we would be aiding and abetting a federal crime. I do believe, though, that given that the state law allows such facilities, I know there's a number of jurisdictions that do allow such facilities, but I haven't done the legal analysis to determine what the potential culpability of the city would be or its city officials.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no more lights, we'll go ahead and open up to the public. Please state your name for the record. Welcome.
Good evening. There it is. My name is Nathan Perot. Just a quick couple of comments. I'll get through this, and then I actually want to address a few other issues. It is true that a few cities have reported crime in and around their areas where these are from. Los Angeles is one of these cities with a Wild West approach to controlling the governing of marijuana co-ops. In Los Angeles, the stores are allowed to open on any location, really. They're allowed to crowd themselves in there, and it's basically uncontrolled with very limited amount of checks and balances over these clinics. Therefore, yeah, there has been a very small amount of crime, certain crimes, some of which was addressed earlier. But, you know, these are common when there are no governing statutes over these people. The increase in crime is similar to that of a liquor store with inadequate security, in an already crime-riddled city. The city of Atascadero bears absolutely no resemblance to the city of Los Angeles in its size, number, or of its dispensaries. It seems unjustified to base the moratorium solely on the data that this is uncontrolled and organized system of dispensaries, patient, or caregiver inside of the business. Today, from where I stand, there is no safe place to obtain medical marijuana within a 100-mile radius. This forces city and county medical marijuana patients to drive as far as Santa Barbara, Fresno, Bakersfield, or even further in order to obtain their medication in a safe and legal way. With hundreds of co-ops to the north, south, and east, why does Central California neglect patients' rights to access medication they deserve by allowing Ordinance 494 to stay in effect? My opinion is that this is a very rushed and hasty decision, in the sense that this city it is a model. It has Ordinance 494, which is perfect. It is extremely hard. It makes it very difficult for the guidelines of where it's going to be placed, who is going to run it. how old the people have to be in order to run it, their criminal backgrounds, which actually is the hardest part that goes unchecked in almost every single city. And so my whole problem with this would be, why are we trying to punish these patients who have never had the ability to gain access to these clinics? And as soon as we are able to open up a clinic under the city's guidelines, which has been in place for 3 years, I believe that we're not going to see any of these problems. I believe that it's going to be...
Sir, please summarize. Your time's up.
Oh, excuse me. And that's about all I have, so thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good evening.
Welcome.
My name is Rich. I just want to address the council that, in essence, what I do is I'm the alternative to allowing a medical marijuana dispensary to open up in the area. Forgive me being a little bit nervous, but this is the first time I address the public on what I do. I currently operate a medical marijuana collective and holistic health service. I have roughly 175 patients in this area, and I do a delivery service for those patients. Without a doubt, the first question these patients ask me when they talk to me is, when are you opening a dispensary? Where are you going to open it up? And it is pretty uncompassionate that the majority of the cities have stopped medical marijuana dispensaries from opening up in their areas. It's available to us to open up a dispensary in the county, but that's kind of scary to someone like me after what had happened to Charles Lynch. We could possibly open up a dispensary in the county, but then we'd be at the mercy of the sheriff's department, and we kind of, after looking at what happened to Charles Lynch, we really don't want to do that. We want to open up in a city. I have AIDS patients, Iraqi war vets that have been paralyzed from the waist down, a grandmother of 84 years who's raising 4 grandchildren that all are having to drive to Santa Barbara typically to receive their medication. I try to help these people, but I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to stay in operation, because quite seriously, I lose money on what I do every week. What we really need is, we need a place like Atascadero to allow us to open up a medical marijuana dispensary. And I understand you want to research it more, but like the other gentleman was saying, it looks like, where do I get my product? I have patients who grow the product and offer that either for donation or a return of fair compensation to other patients who are members of the collective.
So it's like a co-op, is that what you're saying?
Very much so, yeah.
Okay. What I understand now, anybody that gets a marijuana card, so to speak, from a doctor can raise marijuana themselves in their own home, and a lot of them do. Is that not true?
Well, there's a number of patients that do grow their own medical marijuana, but lots of times there's issues with that. Like if there's children nearby or in the home or next door, sometimes people don't feel comfortable with doing it. Also, it's actually not a very easy thing to do. It's a very specialized skill. And not many of the patients that we have, especially the elderly patients, feel comfortable with raising or growing their own medical marijuana.
But at least some of your patients do grow it, and,
oh, yes,
and you distribute. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Any questions? I don't have any other questions. Thank you, though, for offering.
Okay. And, again, I just please ask you, that, I really don't think that there needs to be a 45-day memorandum. What you have on the books right now is already very strict, and we would just like it if you would leave it open to one of us to try to open up a dispensary one of these times. Thank you much.
Thank you, sir. Welcome.
Good evening. My David Broadwater. I would not like to get into the debate about whether or not we need to have or should have a marijuana dispensary in town. What I would like to talk about is taking this from the perspective of the opportunity of the public to have input into this topic. And it is an important topic. I think we need to have just as much time for the public to be able to comment and participate in hearings as under any other ordinance. As you may know, enacting this kind of an ordinance cuts the opportunity for the public to comment and participate in this decision roughly in half. A usual ordinance would have at least a first and second reading. This one won't. It'll go into effect immediately after one hearing. And that would be based upon the section of California law Section 65858A that was cited in the staff report, and that requires that for you to come up with written legislative findings that there's an immediate threat to the public safety, health, and welfare in order to enact this unusual type of urgency ordinance. Now, from what I have been able to tell from comments that I've read of the city attorney in a local newspaper, conversations with the assistant city manager, there, and from what I've heard so far and read in the staff report, there is no immediate threat to the public health and safety and welfare of people in this town. There just isn't any justification, therefore, for enacting an urgency moratorium on this topic, which would, in the process, cut the public input and debate and opportunity to have some influence over this decision in half, at least. That's illegitimate, and it's an invalid application of the law. It would be an abuse of the law. There is no immediate
threat. To have that. And like the man that was before saying that I was just barbecuing and found out about this and stopped my dinner to rush down here because I think it's so important that the community gets educated what the real needs are. We all need to have the right to come up here and speak just like we have the right to vote. I'm a grandmother, a mother, a taxpayer. I own my own home. I work. I don't have time to grow pot. I don't have time to do it. But I have to do everything I can and come out here in the middle of my dinner and say something to somebody that will listen because I'm not the only one. And if we would have known more ahead of time, I assure you I would have had many more people out here to stand up for this that is in his situation or much worse. Thank you.
I don't see anyone else approach the podium, so I'll go ahead and close public comment and bring it back to the council. Or was there anyone want to discuss or make a motion?
Question for the city attorney. We had a citizen offer either a legal opinion or an interpretation of the law about whether or not it was possible for us to do an emergency ordinance. Could you review that and give us your opinion, your legal opinion on the action before us tonight?
Well, my legal opinion is that the action before you tonight is perfectly legal. The Code Section 65858 does allow for a moratorium ordinance on an urgency basis. In terms of the findings, those are set forth in the draft urgency ordinance. It's before you at page 117 and 118 of your packet. The findings go A through J. We specifically note that it's necessary for the city to study the potential impacts of such facilities on public health, safety, and welfare. And I went into some detail previously about some of the problems that have existed with respect to law enforcement issues pertaining to medical marijuana facilities, robberies, et cetera. The one comment that was made was we're cutting the time period in half for an ordinance. That's not entirely correct. An urgency ordinance does go into effect immediately, but this ordinance will only be in effect for a period of 45 days. At the end of that 45 days, there will be another opportunity for the council to decide whether to extend that moratorium. So the public would have 45 days to prepare whatever they wish to prepare, submit it in writing before you consider this the next time, or present whatever speakers want to be here. In terms of this evening's consideration, this was a matter that was on your agenda. It was posted on your agenda. It was posted on the website. There's been complete and full compliance with the Brown Act with respect to such posting. There have been press reports with respect to the item tonight. So this has been an issue that's been open. It's available to the public to comment upon, and it will be available for them to comment upon again in 45 days when this matter returns to you for consideration as to whether to extend the moratorium.
Thank you. So what will come back before us then again, allowing for public input and review of existing
such an ordinance. That ordinance would have a first reading and a second reading and would become effective 30 days thereafter. And in the meantime, you could extend the moratorium during that interim period while that ordinance is being considered by the council.
So then when you come back, we will have those three options, and you could exercise option two and three, that you could extend the moratorium and come back for a second reading of an ordinance to prohibit if we so choose, and there would essentially be additional meetings for public comment on those options.
Yeah, the first reading would not actually take place. When I come to you the next time for the whether to extend the moratorium or not, you would then make a decision. If your decision was to extend the moratorium, you could do that. And if your decision was further to direct that I prepare an ordinance for a first reading to prohibit medical marijuana dispensaries, that would come back to you at a future meeting for a first reading. Then at the following meeting, it would come back for a second reading, and then it would go in effect for 30 days, within 30 days. So there will be, if the council should go in that direction, there would be plenty of opportunity for the public to participate, both in writing or orally during public comment.
So if we adopt staff's recommendation tonight, maybe with some additions, there will be at least one more opportunity for public discussion and possibly as many as three times for public input if at the next meeting we choose to consider another ordinance.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes. I think it's been about 3 years since our first ordinance, and we haven't had an application. I don't know about the urgency. I think it's really a shame that that the medical profession does not handle this, that there's not handled in pharmacies just like any other medication. I think it's a dirty shame that that isn't the situation where doctors could make the recommendation and you get a prescription and you'd go to a pharmacy and it would be filled. The way it is, it sometimes ends up being kind of sleazy and doesn't work out too well. I'm concerned about what happened in Morro Bay and where the federal government got involved. And so my concerns are federal law versus California law and really where we're at with that, and whether our present ordinance needs to be rescinded or maybe tweaked a little bit, whether there's something that we could do there, and just, you know, how important it really is to have that. So I'm supportive of the 45 days. It'll give us a chance to really look at things and see where we're at with this whole situation.
Just to give my input before the motion's made, is I did support this original ordinance, and I do believe that the citizens of California have a right to medical marijuana, but it has been 3 years since this time, and we try to listen to our city attorney to keep us out of trouble, so I want to make sure that we follow his recommendation and have it reviewed. And Councilmember O'Malley, you wanted to make a motion?
Yes, thank you. And I'd like to ensure that we do have our attorney's input and that we have maximum input from the public. So with that, I'm going to move.
Okay. So that takes us to item C3, which is authorization to adopt state video services franchise agreement and impose PEG fees, which is blanking out. I'll have Mr. Lewis explain it to us.
Thank you, Mayor. Good evening, Mayor and members of council. I'm pleased to share with you tonight a report on our franchise agreements and PEG fees, public educational and governmental fees, and we'll learn more about those in just a minute. Tonight before you, we are going to review the existing cable franchise that we currently have with Charter Communications. We'll also talk to you about the state franchise agreement that was approved some years ago. And we also want to consider your direction. You've directed us to come back with an ordinance that would implement PEG fees, but we want to discuss that a bit further with you and see what your desire in that area is. I do want to share in the staff report that we prepared for you, there was an attachment. And the attachment to the report was given to you a few months ago, and we discussed AGP service levels and whether to continue to show council meetings on the internet, et cetera. That was attached to the council report only to revisit the discussion of the break-even points of cameras, what cameras would cost if we put them in the chamber. We didn't put that in the new report. We wanted to keep the new report as short and brief as possible. But there may have been some confusion that we're discussing those issues tonight as well. That is not what we're discussing tonight. We're just discussing whether to enter into the state franchise agreement or not and whether or not to move forward with the imposition of a PEG fee. So that's what we're recommending. We are recommending that you accept the state franchise and move forward with PEG fees and accept a side letter from Charter Communications, and I'll explain more of that in just a moment. So our current situation right now, council meetings are broadcast on the internet, and they're also broadcast on the city's cable channel through Charter Cable. If you have a satellite dish, you don't see the city council meetings on your TV, but you can see them on the internet. The general fund pays for that out of general tax money, and that is allocated in your annual budget. And so the policy questions that you should consider in reviewing our recommendation is that, is it equitable and appropriate for cable subscribers to pay a fee for broadcasting equipment? And that's what this fee will be used for, and we'll get into that. But that's a policy question of who pays for the cameras and related equipment. And is owning a camera system in our best interest as a city in a community, or is renting and leasing a system, kind of like what we do now, in our best interest? So those are really some questions we'd pose to you as you consider my report. The cable franchise agreement in place right now is a contract between the city and Charter Communications. We inherited the agreement as we were a county entity before cityhood. This agreement predates the city, but it's been amended several times. And the existing agreement, as amended, expires in 2016. The council, on a few occasions, has requested an interest in collecting fees that would assist in setting up the camera system. And however, our current agreement would not allow us to charge PEG fees. And so that's something that the cable company has to allow because the fees appear on the bill. And again, I'll get into what a PEG fee is more in just a minute. And so we've had interest in this from previous councils, and we've come back and looked at that. What happened, though, that has made a difference was Charter Communications didn't realize that our existing agreement expires in 2016. The prior agreement expired in 2009, and they were operating under that and moved us under the state franchise agreement without our consent. So that allows our internet to function in our institutional network throughout the city. They don't charge us for that. And through 2016, they're to provide that for free. They also provide us with the connection from this room to the cable system, and they also provide for free cable television at our city facilities and also within the schools. And I think that's a public interest that we protected in our existing agreement. Those privileges would go away under the state franchise agreement. However, we've negotiated a side letter, if you so chose to move to the state agreement, that would maintain those key provisions. Now, why has Charter agreed to this side letter? That's kind of a question we had is, well, if we stayed under the state agreement, we're able to collect the PEG fee as the council had interest in, and for the most part, all else still stayed equal. Again, I'll get into the state agreement in a minute. Why would you offer this side letter? Because that was something that we were interested in. That was always the sticking point. Charter has said that, in plain English, it would reduce their administrative costs substantially. Our agreement was front-end loaded, and so Charter has already put the money into our institutional network, developing the connections between facilities, et cetera. And so now there really isn't much of an ongoing cost of our franchise agreement. So to them, that isn't as much an issue as is they have so many cities out there and so many different agreements they have to follow up on. They have to file an annual report for each franchise agreement with the PUC every year. So if they can consolidate all their agreements under the state agreement, it makes it much simpler for them, and they can streamline some of their operations. As you know, Charter's also in bankruptcy, and they're trying to reshape the corporation to be leaner and able to function better or be purchased from another company. And so consolidating these agreements is of interest to them. And so that's what they explained to us as interest. That does make some sense. So what is the state cable franchise that we've been placed under? I talked about our agreement a little bit. Our agreement, again, allows for the use of the institutional network between facilities, cable television, and it allows for the connection to the cable network. The local franchise agreement allows
us to set customer service standards and enforce customer service issues. We don't get a lot of those, particularly in the age of competition. Before, you only had cable TV, and if you didn't have an antenna, you couldn't get a signal. We were a little more interested in the service that we were receiving. But nowadays, with satellite and other options, there's more competition, so the cable companies have really tried to step up. But in 2006, the state adopted DIVCA, which you can see basically was a statewide cable franchise. This was at the lobby of the cable companies. They didn't want all these separate agreements out there. They were trying to streamline. It went into effect a little over 2 years ago. What this does is this limits local agreements in our control. And so now if there's concerns or changes to the cable system, we would have to work through the Public Utilities Commission. I checked some other cities that have worked through this process that hasn't been much of a problem because really, frankly, we don't have as many issues anymore, again, because of the competition. And it does provide a customer service oversight. Again, if the cable company has problems today under our local franchise, it's upon staff to try and work through that as opposed to us being able to turn it over to the state. And they've been somewhat responsive in these issues. And most important, per what you've directed us to, the state agreement allows for the collection of PEG fees. And that's something that has been in discussion for a while. So what are these? These are fees charged to cable customers, so the consumer, for public, educational, and governmental programming. For tonight, we're talking about governmental programming. That is what our policy that you've approved allows for. That is how we use our channel. It is for very basic governmental programming, i.e. commission meetings, council meetings. If there were a fire safe video that the fire department wanted to show for fire season, you would pay 1% or 40 cents. A month on your bill towards this fee. So that's what the fee is. So it would be paid by the subscribers. We estimate it generate between $35,000 and $45,000 for the city annually. And you can see, again, a $75 bill would be 75 cents. Now, the fee can only be collected on the amount that's actually used. And so part of this is we have to provide a plan to the cable company every year for how we're using the money and what we're purchasing and how, if we're depreciating cameras, that sort of thing. We submit that plan, and then the cable company would collect the revenue and remit it to us. If there was a year where we didn't need cameras or anything else, we would not collect the fee. If there were years where we needed the full fee up to the 1%, we would collect the fee. And so the council would impose the fee based on our plan, and the cable company would then remit it to us. 47% of households subscribe to cable services, so that's the group we're talking about. It's almost 50-50, but not quite. All cities in the county charge a PEG fee for this purpose, including the county, except for the city of Atascadero and Paso Robles, just to give you an example of, and again, this is a local decision per your local franchise, and that's what your neighboring communities have decided to do. If you wanted to go forward with the PEG fee, and again, that would mean adopting the state franchise, there would be the hearing this evening before the council to consider the fee and move forward with an ordinance. If that passed and went through second reading, et cetera, then we would actually develop a budget for how we would use that and submit that to the cable company with our purpose and our amount. They would need to approve that. And once they approve that, we would collect, then the fee would be on the bill for 90 to 120 days and the revenue would be remitted to the city, at which point then we could use that to purchase camera equipment. Now, big picture of this, so why are we here? Again, this goes back to the consideration of should we have, is it better to own or lease and who pays for the system? Should we own a camera system here? And in the report that you were given several months ago, we talked about a break even of if we owned our own camera system. Again, currently, the general fund, we hire AGP Video of Morro Bay. They set up the cameras every other meeting or every meeting every other week for this purpose. And their staff time, et cetera, is built into the cost. If we owned the system, we would have more flexibility as far as who provided that service. However, the savings we would net from the current contract to what we would be paying for the system would provide about a 6 to 10 year break even, depending on the type of system we purchased. And so just as you were breaking even, you'd be needing to buy a new system. So there was that's something for you to consider. Is it really better to own than lease? If you do own, you do have control of the cameras. It's easier to use them for different things. We still would have to figure out how to staff the cameras. We don't have that ability, and so we'd have to look at alternative models. But, again, better to own than lease, and who pays for the system. So staff is recommending that we move towards the state franchise and accept the side letter with charter. If the council is inclined to move forward with the PEG fee, that is our recommendation, then that is the appropriate action. If we are not inclined to move forward with the PEG fee, and I've kind of positioned it this way, then I think we'd want to review whether the state franchise is really right for us or that we stay under our local franchise through 2016. But that seemed to be the most significant carrot we wanted to share with you if we're to move. So with that, that concludes the report I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you for your excellent report, and I'm glad you touched on the issue of do we always have to charge 1%, because that was one thing that came in my mind, is that if we don't use the money, we shouldn't collect it. So I'm glad that there's that mechanism that we can adjust it to what our needs are. I just want to say, you know, I've heard some people say, well, if I don't, why should only the people who get cable?
Yes, I had a couple of questions. You mentioned lease. Can you use PEG fees to lease equipment?
It's my understanding that you can't, but does Brian, do you know offhand?
I believe it has to be a purchase for it to be capital.
That's my understanding, too. Okay. It's a capital.
And you're saying that it'll take about 6 to 10 years to break even, and the equipment will be obsolete by that time?
It would depend on the type of equipment. I think it'd last about that long or more. It's a pretty simple use. We have a very narrow field of vision for the cameras, and in this room it's for a meeting only. So we'd probably definitely get the 6 years, but, you know, people's tastes change over time with technology, so it's right. A tough call.
So we would, in other special meetings, who would operate the equipment? You know, like...
Right, so
you mentioned if the fire department wanted to do something, or who would operate the equipment?
Sure, that's a good question. I'll say, consistent with every other message we've been telling you, we do not have resources in the budget or staff to operate this. And so what this would allow, if you had your own equipment, AGP could still operate it for us. Their hourly rate would be lessened because they don't have to bring the equipment. And so it would be here, and they'd just send staff members in a car. Mm-hmm. And so they would reduce, and that's why I attached the other report, because I had more detailed information in there. Yeah. That marginal savings between what they charge us today to set it up and what they charge us if we had our own is how I determine the break-even analysis. And so because that's the difference. That's the delta. So to answer your question, if someone wanted to use it, we'd have to set up a fee structure, and we could have AGP or some other provider. Again, the reason, one of the many reasons we use AGP is that they're the only company that has the comprehensive ability to set up cameras, et cetera. There are a few people in town who have businesses that can't set up the equipment but could definitely operate it. And so you'd have a more competitive marketplace for the operation of the cameras, and I guess we could have a fee program.
Would the cameras be in place all the time so you could get someone just to operate it that you understand?
Yes.
Where you wouldn't have to?
Yes, and that's one of the benefits to having an in-house camera system, we believe, and it's part of our recommendation. This is a perfectly acceptable fee to charge, if you deem so, for this use, and it would allow us to have an in-house system with cameras that we believe would provide a more reliable picture. I know that we've had some reliability concerns, a consistent picture, and we'd have that flexibility that if you wanted to broadcast something from this room at a given notice, if our operator was available, you could.
I was thinking something like the earthquake, you know, mm-hmm. where maybe the mayor would have a message for the community and so on, or the city manager and so on. And then what happens after 2016?
So after 2016, we will be placed under the state franchise. We do not have an option. So our option today is to exit our agreement early, but we will go under it eventually.
Okay, but I mean as far as the letter from a charter, what happens after 2016 in regards to this building and the schools and all that stuff?
Well, charter hasn't set up a fee yet for that type of thing, but they no longer would be legally required to provide it for free under the agreement.
Is there any way to negotiate now before we get to that point where they would?
If we stayed under our local agreement, we might have more ability to do that. We did try, as you had directed us a few months ago, to try and get further than 2016, but they weren't interested in that, and frankly, they didn't have an incentive to do so. And they do have stipulations, because the cable company's interest is in us not charging this fee, because it raises the bottom line of their bill. And so when people look at the cable bill compared to a satellite bill, that the cable company honestly has that concern. And so they're very they will scrutinize how we use the money, and that's why we have to have a plan, and we'll have to file kind of an annual how we used the money before they continue to charge it. And so that's an accountability we would have to them. So, yes.
So obviously the first year we would have a fairly small pot of money, and it wouldn't be enough to buy all of the equipment. So would we be buying this incrementally and increasing our system, and within the 6 years or so we would be up and running, or how would this work?
Well, we could loan ourselves the money. Cable companies have also fronted the money based on a plan for what they will collect, and Charter has shared with us that that would be something they would consider give us a year front and then collect the money, and then we'd start generating it. We could wait a year if we didn't want to do that, and then put in, if we had a plan in place over 3 years, to put in the system. There are several models. If we move forward with this, we definitely put more effort into looking at that.
Okay, and if we were to look at other cities that have collected the PEG fees, are they paying less for their video production than we are currently?
I don't know that offhand. I know in some of the models they do have part-time workers using the cameras, and that could be cheaper than what we're currently paying. We believe that just in our own, we did some research when we were looking at the benefits and the break-even analysis of buying the cameras, and there were some cheaper hourly staffing models. So that is one of the incentives. I would look more into that if that's something you ask us to do.
Do you anticipate any city expenses to administer these costs?
There's definitely going to be staff time, and there could be some outside expenses related to maintenance and other review, yes.
And I've been contacted by several members in the public that are looking at this as if it were a tax, but I've heard from others that this is a fee. Could you explain the difference for the public?
Yes, so the difference of a tax is something that is broad-based to a jurist. This isn't the true legal definition per se. Maybe Brian could take a better shot at it. But in layman's terms, a tax is something the council would pass on to the entire community. It would be paid by all residents, whether they utilize the service or not, and it would be used for a broad purpose. So, for example, the sales tax. If you never buy anything, you wouldn't pay the sales tax. If you buy a lot, you pay the sales tax, and that tax money can be used for whatever the council deems. It's a general purpose collection. A fee is for a specific purpose charged to the users of that purpose. And so in this sense, the fee is being charged to the cable subscribers for the privilege they have of being able to watch the council meeting on the television. If you don't watch the television or the council meeting on television, then you wouldn't pay the fee because you don't have the cable system.
But in effect, the Charter cable customers are subsidizing those in the general public that are not using Charter cable. Is that not correct?
I think you could make that statement, and that was one of the policy questions staff posed to you earlier, is that in the current situation, people are watching it on cable, and they are watching it on the Internet, and the general taxpayer, the general fund, is paying that cost. If we move forward to a camera system and you still had it on the Internet, the cost of that camera system is being paid for by the cable subscriber, not the dish subscriber. That would be true.
And one last question. You stated that with the local Charter cable franchise, there was an element of accountability, that there was some place locally that they could complain, and that would be the city. At this stage, if we were to go to the state one, where would they complain?
Denny, I can't remember the last time we received a complaint. Aside from our connection to this meeting and our camera system, we've worked with AGP on that, about Charter services.
Thank
you. It's been a long time.
Councilmember Kelly.
Yes, I'm wondering if you had made a projection of the cost of the equipment, the cost to maintain it, the cost to operate it, the cost for probably a reserve fund to maintain it or refurbish it after a few years, and the administrative costs that might be incurred, what the net savings would be to the city if we had our own system.
I think it starts getting pretty thin. We've done a ballpark analysis, and that was in your previous report. The system's going to cost you, let's take a look here.
I think you said 30 to 40.
Yeah, $30,000 to $40,000. You can use the money to have spare parts and to fix a camera if it breaks, or that related to your capital cost, but there starts to become a gray area as far as how much maintenance we can charge and what types of staff. Undoubtedly, if we own the system and had directly manage a contract and people coming in here, there will be staff costs. That's something we're concerned about. We're not currently staffed for that. And so that is something we'd have to take a look at. And frankly, we haven't done the real detailed analysis that you've asked for because we wanted to see if we're moving in this direction. And as part of our plan, we would, you know, come back and really show you that. But our best estimate from what we've done, Councilmember Kelly, is we believe it's pretty close. This probably isn't a real financial decision. What you're doing is you're getting the increased benefit of having, of owning cameras and having that ability to do other programming and other things.
I'd be interested in having those figures because we're taking on a heck of a responsibility with costs, with equipment and staff time and what have you. And there'd have to be a little disparity, you know, for me between the what we're doing now and putting our own system in. So I personally would like to, you know, see an analysis of all the projected costs.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Thank you.
Well, I guess my question centered around, I think in these times, whether you call it a tax or a fee, I'm concerned about adding anything to anybody's bill anywhere. And it seems to me that for the charter customers, it's going to be an increased cost and really no increased benefit from what they currently receive. The question is there really a benefit to the city overall, meaning are we really going to lower our costs or generate revenue that's going to offset costs that benefits everyone citywide? And it looks to me this is more of a break-even for the city, and it might give us some more options, but I don't think we're in a position to be actively looking for more options these days. I think we're wanting to be as cost-effective as we can. And so this is where I'm not clear. I'm with Councilmember Kelly. If I was going to do something, I'd want to see a clear benefit before we ask any of our citizens to pay more. It sounds like there may be some benefit if we own the equipment. We might be able to go out to bid for who operates it, and because there's no particular cost savings for us owning our own equipment given the length of life on the equipment. The only benefit could be if we are able to lower our operating costs because we own the equipment and can have other folks bid on.
Just to tell you, you could save $5,000 a year or $6,000 a year and maybe have some increased functionality, but
our community, though? That $5,000 is completely coming out of our community, basically, in the form of the fees.
Definitely. And so that's something you need to consider. And I guess that's what we would suggest before we do further analysis. We're more than happy to do that. But it seems if there's enough of a consensus from you that you think this isn't a direction you want to go for a while, then we wouldn't do that analysis.
Thank you.
We seem to be straying from questions, and I do want to get some public input. Do you have a question or is it discussion?
A statement.
A statement. Can you wait until after we get some public input?
Sure.
Okay, so let's bring it back to public comment period. So I will open it up. Please state your name for the record.
Good evening. I'm Len Colomarino. I'm an Atascadero resident. And I want to speak in favor of going in this direction with the PEG fees. This is a very valuable tool that we have, being able to broadcast the meetings to the public, and it's worth something. The only regret I have is that I can't pay anything, and there are a lot of free riders like me who don't get Charter television. I have Charter cable, and I take very large advantage of having broadcast available on the internet, and more importantly, even the archiving. But I can't contribute. I don't think it's too much to ask people to pay user fees of this very small amount to have the broadcasting, but those of us who are taking advantage of the computer access, it's worth even more to. So what occurred to me was whether to assist the city further in defraying some of the costs of this broadcasting that I think everybody agrees is very valuable to the community, whether there would be a way to enable people like me to contribute. For example, if there were a legend on the web page that you have to go to access the computer broadcast or to get an archive of the broadcast, if there were a legend that said, if you would like to contribute something to defray the city's costs, you can do so by sending, following this procedure. Might even suggest perhaps $10 a year per computer in your household or something like that. I know I would certainly be ready to pay something like that, and I suspect there are a few hundred people in the community who would be willing to do that every year, and, that adds up to a few thousand dollars. So I think this PEG fee is good. I think it's well worth it. It's a user fee that is not substantial for a very valuable service. I would hope, though, that you'd find a way to enable people like me not to be a free rider and to pay something for the extremely valuable computer access that we have.
Thank you.
Consequences of costs that go along with it. You have your personnel costs. You have your upgrade costs. Some manager gets in and they want something else. So you have continual software upgrading. So there's additional costs there. You need a complete, comprehensive spreadsheet that lays out all of the costs versus the benefits. There's another item in here of about a 5% fee that can be charged in the state franchise thing. How's it worded? The state franchise allows for the collection of a 5% franchise fee, and it provides for pay channels for government programming. Now, it wasn't made clear in these documents as to who pays that, but I can tell you right now, if the state collects it from charter, charter's going to pass it on to the cable subscribers. One other question. How many council members have cable versus not having cable? Right? I would recommend that we stay with the current program, get charter to step back up, honor the 2016. It'll give us plenty of time to do the kind of analysis that we need to do. It'll also give us an opportunity to gain from the experience of other cities that, since they are already on this. We know what our costs are. We know what we can do here. So I would recommend that we stay with that. I would recommend that we do not go the PEG route. And also, I'd like to bring something else up. I think it ties into this as far as the plan and the televising of the Planning Commission meetings. I think the appropriate thing to do on that is a modification in how it's determined as to which meetings are televised. I think the planning chair and the community development director should be able to get together and make a decision. If they can't reach a decision, then it should go to the city council. But I think it should be televised. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good evening, David Broadwater. I want to strongly support the staff recommendation for going forward with PEG fees. Taxpayers are already paying for this. The money's coming out of the general fund. That's tax money. So as far as a tax fee, whatever, it's already a burden on taxpayers because it's being paid out of the general fund. We started talking about doing this kind of thing back in 2006, finally started it in 2007. We know that it's quite popular among people in the community. It's supported. There was a recommendation a few months back to cancel some of the internet archiving and videoing of meetings, and that was maintained because of the value recognized of the program. Once we get it onto solid foundation, eventually, like some other cities do, it could be opened up to the participation by other members of the community, high school organizations that might want to put on a program, or other community organizations. That's a door that's open to us down the road as we develop further. So I think this is all very, very positive. Puts us on a solid foundation for the future, and so I strongly urge the council to move forward with entering the state franchise agreement and establishing PEG fees. It's the right thing to do. Thank you.
David Bentz, 113F Meadows. I think until you give the 5,500 people that are going to pay this tax an opportunity to be heard, that you should delay your action and wait for that, because you don't have anyone here that is going to be responsible for paying it so that they could tell you what they think about you levying that fee. So this is not an opportune time for those people to be standing before you. Now it'll get into the news and they'll come back at a future hearing date and tell you what they think about imposing the PEG fees, as well as whether or not that 5% fee that is going to be charged as a franchise fee to the cable operators, whether it gets passed on to them also. So I would encourage you to solicit the people that are going to pay for this and hear from them. Thank you.
Seeing no one else approach the podium, I'll close public comment and bring it back to the council. There was one question, Mr. Lewis, something about a 5%. I don't remember reading that in the report. Is this part of your report that I missed?
I would be very pleased to. Okay. I meant to include that in my report. Thank you, Sandy, for bringing that up. The 5% franchise fee is something that we've collected in franchises since history. That is paid by the corporation, Charter Corporation. That's 5% of their gross revenues collected from this community that they pay for the privilege of operating within our right-of-way, for tearing up our streets, et cetera. Right. That funding goes to the general fund to offset the costs that we harbor from fixing the streets, and et cetera. So that's a license fee, basically, to operate in our community paid by Charter, not by subscribers directly.
Now, we're talking about people who don't get Charter. Now, there is no franchise fee from, like, I get Wild Blue for my internet. There is no franchise fee that comes back to the city from those other providers. Is that correct, or is there?
That's correct. Wireless companies have thus far avoided franchise fees because of their physical presence and their footprint is much less. Charter actually tears up our streets to lay different pieces of the system into the street, et cetera. Franchise fees are routinely collected. We collect franchise fees from our waste hauling company, from our utility companies. And so it is something from this was considered a utility company back when cable companies began. And so it was very common to collect such a fee.
Okay. Thank you. I see a lot of lights here. And I do have a request to take a break. So do you want to do this quickly or should we take a break now?
I would just soon push through this
okay,
item.
Okay, let's do that. Councilmember O'Malley.
Thank you. I do appreciate some of the Mr. Benson, and he does take advantage of computer use and found it extremely valuable. I don't want to see a citizen volunteer like that go to waste. And I did want to confirm, my understanding is anyone could write a check to the city of Atascadero, and it's a contribution. You would be able to get that to Rochelle and get that deposited and help defray costs. That's something we could do. I'm checking with the city manager.
Absolutely.
That's what I thought. So I wanted to make sure, Mr. Colomarino, you completely understood. Extremely valuable. I don't know what that means to you. I think at least $10 a month is fair. That would be $120 a year. And I do not want you to feel that you cannot contribute. So thank you for that offer. City of Atascadero, Rochelle Rickard will help you out. And anyone else that would like to help with that, much like Councilmember Kelly, Clay and I voluntarily offered to help defray the fee with the Veterans Memorial. I think citizens stepping forward is a good thing. So I commend you, Mr. Colomarino, for that offer. With that, though, I am very concerned about passing on a fee to anyone at this point in time. I don't see a lot of benefit. There could be in the future. I certainly want to look at that, but I don't see added benefit at this point in time.
Councilmember Kelly.
Okay. I'm against taxation and fees unless they're absolutely necessary. I look in the report here and it says that the income from this fee could be up to $45,000 a year. And the net profit to the city is $5,000 or $6,000. I cannot justify in any way taxing the citizens of Atascadero $45,000 so the city can save $5,000 or $6,000. It's got to be bureaucracy at its best. And the people of Atascadero have spoken very strongly about wanting to have these meetings televised, and we've all agreed that we're willing to step up to the plate and pay for it. And like I say, we don't have near the information to even make the decision, but at this point, I would have to really get some vital information that there was a significant savings to the city to justify the taxation or the fee, excuse me.
Councilmember McQuay?
Yes, I have a question for Jim. The statement was made so any community organization can use the facility, or that's not true, right?
That is not true. So we currently have a government channel, and this fee would be for that, and your policy is pretty specific that that is not necessarily the case.
So it would have to be something involved with the city or a government.
That's how your policy currently states.
Okay, appreciate that. The other thing is when we get down to voting for this, I would appreciate if we took them. There's five suggestions here, and then we take them one at a time. And in regards to number five, I'm in favor of discontinuing the broadcasting of Planning Commission meetings, except at the request. What's that?
I think you're looking at an attachment.
Oh, that's an old one?
Yes.
You go back to the first page.
Sorry about that. But I'm still in favor of it. Yes.
Mr. Clay, and, I have another light.
I was thinking maybe there's a little elder abuse here, but we're doing all right.
You can put your light on if you come up with another comment. Councilmember Fonzie.
I think what Mr. Broadwater stated about this being participating in PEG is a commitment to televise. I like that concept. I want to make sure that we continue to televise our meetings, and I want that very clear to the public that this council definitely supports it. But there is a bit of whimsy to this because succeeding councils may change their mind about the televising. If you're participating in the PEG fees, you've made that very public commitment. I think that actually has some merit and needs to be thought through. That being said, I feel that the public hasn't had an adequate opportunity to vet this, that this was on our agenda, but it isn't truly a hearing. It's a management report. It hasn't been out on the really televised in any way, which we are doing tonight. It hasn't been in our newspapers, and there's been no discussion with letters or among the public. I would really like to see the public weigh in on this, and they may have very different opinions than we do, but I'd like to hear them. So personally, I don't know how we would put this on the agenda as a hearing item, but that's where I'd like to see it go.
I can wait. I was questioning. Oh, is it my turn?
Just because everyone had a chance to say something, I'll just go ahead and interject my thoughts, and then we can do round two if we need to. Is that okay? I think it's good that the PEG fees are scrutinized and that we actually have to have a need before we collect the money. I think that's a very important point of the PEG fees. I am interested from a public's point of view to have better programming and have more programming from the public sector available on cable and on the internet. And I do think that we've talked about this quite a bit, and I think that if there really wasn't an outrage about a fee, that some people would have shown up tonight because it was on the agenda. We've talked about this a couple different times. And I know when I look at any bill, like my mobile phone bill, I got all kinds of users' fees up on every single line I have. I have four phones in my house, and so you'd be amazed how many fees I pay for that pays for the people who can't hear or the people who can't see or things like that. So we pay user fees in a lot of different ways for the common good, and I think this is another one of those common good kind of fees. I think we should move forward with the PEG fees. I'm willing to go along with Councilmember Fonzie and make it an official public hearing if the council feels there needs to be more time. I'd go along with that. So I'll continue with the lights. And I do have Mr. McKinney's light on, or is that the city attorney's light?
Yes, that's mine. And I just wanted to encourage the council. This isn't one of your top priorities. This was an issue that you were visiting. And we have consumed a lot of time tonight and staff time working on this project. So if there isn't really a consensus to move forward, we should put this off because you do have a lot of pressing projects out there. And rather than you know, labor it and come back for another public hearing ironing out $50,000 worth of cost, I think we should either move forward or put this off.
Thank you for those comments. Councilmember O'Malley.
Well, I did think it was a good observation that Councilmember Fonzie brought up about the wanted to hear from the public. If folks wanted to come forward and say, please raise my fees, I would certainly want to hear that. I don't expect that that's what we would hear.
Is that a motion?
Is there a consensus to move forward on this issue?
I move we do not adopt staff's recommendation.
I'll second that motion.
Okay. Motion by Councilmember O'Malley, seconded by Councilmember Clay. Roll call, please.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Yes.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie.
Yes.
Mayor Barreau.
No.
4-1, motion passes.
Okay, and we will take a 15-minute break.
Okay.
Mr. Ward, just up to the podium for a very brief statement of some good news tonight. So, Mr. Ward.
Thank you. Madam Mayor, members of the City Council, this is one of the few times where I was not disappointed that one of my ideas was shot down. Because of the generosity, as I walked from this lectern out, people shook my hand, put money in it, and by the time I got out in the lobby and saw someone coming through the door from the ATM machine at the Bank of America, and when I counted everything, there was exactly $1,000. So not only do we have enough to pay the city's fees this year, but we have enough to pay it next year.
Good. So don't come back next year.
All right.
Good job, Chuck.
So, no, it's not a good job for me. It's a good job for you guys. You've got the ball rolling. Come Saturday, bring your wallet, your credit card, and an upwelling of enthusiasm and generosity, and we're going to have a very successful fundraiser. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. So we'll go back to our agenda. We're on item C4, which is the very near the end of the agenda, luckily for everybody. And I'm getting all kind of symbols, but it's the Atascadero Subbasin, Paso Robles Groundwater Basin Study Participation, and I believe Russ Thompson is going to be giving this report.
Yes, thank you, Mayor and Council. I'm here tonight to talk a little bit about the Paso Robles Groundwater Study, and more particularly the Atascadero Subbasin. Get this going here. As you may be aware, that San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District for some years has been studying the Paso Robles groundwater basin, as there's been concerns about serious decline in groundwater levels primarily east of Paso Robles, between Paso Robles and Shandon, and more recently. As part of the county's resource capacity study, they commissioned a report. Actually, it was so that the groundwater levels in our area or in the Atascadero subbasin were actually increasing. We're getting higher and not being depleted. So there was a number of questions that came up when we started reviewing the report, as questions that the water company and Templeton Community Service District in the city of Paso Robles, I think all were questioning some of the conclusions that were being drawn by this study. And so through our participation in the Water Resource Advisory Committee, we started questioning the report and the conclusions that county planning was drawing from the report. As part of their resource capacity study, the county planning department was recommending to the Planning Commission that they enact a level of severity 3 for the Atascadero subbasin area. And even though normally we're not subjected to county planning policies, or they don't have jurisdiction in our land use decisions, by implementing the level of severity 3 conclusion, it would have impacted all of the environmental studies that we do. It would have complicated, if not prevented, annexations into the city, and all of the environmental determinations that we would do on projects that were brought forward within the city. If we didn't address the groundwater conditions each time. For example, the Walmart EIR would have to have a specific section and study every time as to what the current status of the groundwater basin was. So we feel that in a proactive way, we were concerned about this as its impact on the city. And so once we got into this report, started talking to the water company, the city of Paso Robles, Templeton Community Service District, we all were coming up with a number of questions in this study. And so the Water Resource Advisory Committee decided to formulate a subcommittee to study these concerns. And it was made up primarily of water or North County water purveyors and the city. There was also an agricultural representative to review the report. And it's a little difficult on this map, but I'm going to try to point out. Okay, the outline of this is the entire Paso Robles groundwater basin. You've got Paso Robles in the middle on the left side, and it goes out to Shandon out here. It goes up into Monterey County at the north end of this map. And then Atascadero, the Atascadero sub-basin is this lower left corner here. And what's this is an exhibit from the report, and what's kind of important about this exhibit is the areas in yellow and orange are the areas of declining water level. And the areas of blue are the actual levels where they documented that levels were increasing. So you can see down in this, down in the lower left-hand corner in here, it's primarily blue, which would indicate rising groundwater levels. And so, in that area. That's the Atascadero. And there was the number of the Salinas River aquifer. And so that makes up a large recharge component of the Salinas River aquifer and consequently the Paso Robles aquifer or Paso Robles groundwater basin. So there was a number of just large scales. We weren't really trying to nitpick the report, but there were some big picture items that weren't being considered. And I think the county planning department was jumping to trying to get to an end result without having all the data available to them. So through this subcommittee, we had a number of meetings where we studied the content of the Todd report and the previous report that was done by Fugro, which was a much more comprehensive report, and went through these numbers with the hydrogeologist. And they agreed. They agreed with all of our concerns, saying, you know, you've got good points. What you're asking is beyond the scope of the study that was done by Todd. And they said it needs to go to the next level. To draw the conclusions that county planning was trying to draw from this data, you needed to go to one more step in this study. And so what we ended up recommending was that the subcommittee, after a review of the report, that an additional study is required to improve this analysis and to give a more complete picture, more of a water balance, to make sure that while they're studying the amount being taken out, that it's equally important to study the amount of water being recharged back into the groundwater basin, and it clearly wasn't being done. And so this study... we went through, kind of tried to limit the scope of what was going to be studied to keep it. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel, but we wanted to make sure that some of these big picture items were being carefully considered because it had dramatic effects on all of the agencies. And the rather than trying to find determine a system where we came up with some complex cost-sharing methodology on who was a bigger agency or who had more customers. We felt like when we were talking at subcommittee level, we thought we were going to be in the $5,000 to $10,000 range per jurisdiction, that at that point, because this information had the effect of this, the study was going to have equally affect each agency, we decided to recommend that the cost be shared equally by the City of Atascadero, the City of Paso Robles, Templeton Community Service District, the water company, and the county was going to pay all an equal share. So the proposal was received back from the consultant, it was determined that each agency's share was going to be $12,840 to provide this extra level of study. We've included what we're recommending tonight just so that we don't have to come back to you if there's any other miscellaneous expenses, as we're including overhead expenses so that we could reproduce the report or have patient and commitment to the process to make sure that there was good decisions being made from a good information, that we recommend that you authorize us to participate in this study. I think that's pretty well it. I think the staff report covers maybe some of the details in addition to what I presented tonight, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Councilman Clay.
Russ. I'm really concerned that they come up with, I'm going to say a fraudulent determination. I mean, you've seen the map. We're in the blue area, which indicates that the water is not receding. It's actually increasing. And then to put us in a Category 3, whatever, it blows my mind. This could affect, you mentioned the Walmart project, which, may or may not come the way I'm looking at it. It would affect all other commercial, the Tractor Supply Store, even Colony Square. I mean, this is really bad. And there was another figure in there that in regards to the usage per acreage that Todd used, and it was really, really high. Right. And the water company, do you remember those figures?
I don't remember the exact numbers, but the Todd report had included a water factor for rural residential properties.
Right.
From properties like in the 2.5 to maybe 7 or 10 acre range. And then with respect to the Atascadero sub-basement, John Neal at the water company has years and years of history,
exact,
by parcel size,
exact figures,
water
right,
use.
Right,
and it was, I want to say it was about a third to maybe, 40% of what Todd was using. And so those were the kind of things that were being brought up at these committee reports, that it's just, here's the information, we have it. You don't have to guess. You don't have to extrapolate it. Yeah. Here's, 40 years of water use data from the water company. We want you to use this.
Right. And
again, things like Nospiana water and return flows through the sewer systems. And we didn't even get into septic system recharge and some of those little finer points, because we just didn't want to complicate it, but we did want them to look at the big picture items.
Well, that figure alone was projected into the future, and it was ridiculous, from what I've seen. I think it's unfortunate that we got to come up with the $16,000, but I think in order to protect, our community and still be able to get these larger commercial projects going, I think that we have to do it. But it's a shame that it went that way.
And I should add that the other I believe that the other agencies have all agreed and signed on to the agreement. So I think there was maybe us and maybe one other agency that was still looking for a determination.
Councilmember Fonzie.
I just wanted to say thank you, Russ and staff, for being on top of this. This could have been something that was snuck under the door here, and you were paying attention and you did attend the meetings, and I think this was a very important thing for you to do. If I'm understanding you correctly, if this had been enacted and not disputed,
and didn't address this global kind of groundwater basin issue, it would just be one more way for somebody to bring a legal challenge against the determination. And so I think it's money well spent now, because I think from the amount of study and input we've had already, we can see that, and the county I think has already pretty well acknowledged that they can see by just taking these big picture numbers that we're talking about, that it's going to swing, you know, the level of severity from a 3 to a 1, where it's more of a concern, but it doesn't have all these alarms going off, because it's, the bottom line is their testing and their results show that the groundwater levels are increasing. And oddly enough, in the Todd report, and there's a, I think there was some at the county level, you look at the area east of Paso Robles, clearly, as everybody knows, talk to well drillers, that groundwater basin is going down and down quickly. But because it was primarily agriculture, that this report pretty much didn't really want to address or assign a level severity of 3 to that area. So there, it was just, again, it was one of those inconsistencies, didn't make sense. You know, so there's that political part of agriculture and,
right.
And you know, right to farm and those kind
Can
of
you
things.
Can you explain what the difference will be between the scope of this Fugro study versus Todd, so we know what we're paying for?
Yeah. And I probably could go into more detail on that. Fugro did the original study of the Paso Robles groundwater basin. It was a very comprehensive water balance type study and very extensive. The Todd report focused only on one aspect of it, and that was to update the pumping, how much water is being drawn out. So the county had to do kind of their own little, they had the Fugro report, and then they had the Todd report, and they kind of drew their conclusions from both of those reports about assigning levels of severity. And even the Fugro geoscientist looked at Todd's report and the way they did their analysis, and the data for the amount of water being taken out, with the exception of the residential assumptions they made, and I don't want to get too technical here, but what we're going to do is we're recommending that Fugro update pretty much one table. It's kind of the key table in their report that kind of, it's like a, if you can picture a big spreadsheet of all the flows going in and coming out, what they're going to do is take that table, take the good elements or the accurate elements of the Todd report, plug those in, and kind of rerun their analysis and then draw, you know, updated conclusions from it. I don't know. It's a much more thorough. I mean, I think Todd, not to downplay what they did, I think they did exactly what they're asked to do. It's just that the Fugro report was more comprehensive and took a look at all the elements.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is, when, if we pay for this and this study is completed, then the county and
the Planning Commission, this resource capacity study has to come back to the County Planning Commission. So it's going to be, I'm guessing, probably about 6 months before it's kind of resolved.
Well, once they have all this data and everything and come together with this conclusion, and the Nazi Metal pipeline goes online, does that throw the whole thing off again? To our advantage, probably.
Well, one of the things that was not in the Todd report is they made the assumption, well, Nazimeno water's not here. Right now, it's not flowing through the pipe, even though we all know it's, you know, a year away. So it seems prudent for a document of this scope. You know, it's, I mean, we don't need to know what the water use is today, you know, necessarily. But, I mean, we all know Nazimeno's coming. We know it's going to be a water source that all these communities are using. You should take that into account. So this, what we're recommending, the update will include the Nazimeno water.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no more questions from the council, I'll go ahead and open up to public comment. Anyone want to speak on this item? Seeing no one approach the podium, we'll close it. Public comment and bring it back to the council. Any comments or a motion?
I'd like to move that we go with staff's recommendation.
Second.
Motion by Councilmember Clay, seconded by Councilmember O'Malley. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember O'Malley?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor Barrow? 5-0, motion passes. Yes.
Thank you. Moving on. That was our last management report. We go to council announcements and reports. Anybody? Councilman Clay?
Announcements or, well, yeah, I have something I'd like to talk to the public about. I'm really concerned about our restaurants in Atascadero. A lot of them are just hanging on by a thread, and, use them or lose them is the way I'm looking at this. Denny's closed today, and I remember when Sambo's opened, and it was the first all-night restaurant we had, and how nice it was to get up at 4 in the morning and go to work and be able to go in there and get a cup of coffee or breakfast. I think it's sad that Denny's closed. 4 or 5 years ago, they were the number one Denny's in the United States, and they went down in the tubes like this. What I've heard that most of the business, the restaurants in the downtown area lost about 30% of their business when the movie theater moved. And so what I'm recommending for everybody out there, including myself, is when you go to Paso, I mean, you're going to go to the movies. We understand that. You're going to do shopping. And some people work in San Luis, and they shop there and shop in Paso. Instead of take the 10-minute drive or the 15-minute drive and come home and patronize our own restaurants. The recent reports from our consultant indicated that 70% of the people in Atascadero that eat in restaurants eat out of town, and we've got to reverse that. We're going to lose our restaurants, folks. A couple, three of them are just hanging on, and, you know, I hear this thing, well, we don't have good variety. Believe me, there's plenty of restaurants out there, and there's good variety. I think Steve Martin said there's something like 14 restaurants in the downtown area. So please, if you go out of town, just take in a parking lot unless it's paved. And I think of the festivals that Alps had up there, and they had smoking areas, and they were like for 8 hours, and there was like, you know, several thousand people up there. So I think we need to reconsider some of these ordinances. The lake area, the lake park, there's certainly some dirt parking lots there that need to be reconsidered. And then also out at Paloma Park, you have the arena area for horses, and that's the parking lot there is all dirt. And believe me, those cowboys, they chew, and I'm sure some of them smoke. So what we have here is an ordinance that's going to make lawbreakers out of a lot of people, and that bothers me. I stated that I went to the wine festival, and my mission for 2 hours was just to find a smoker, and I finally did find one. And I talked to one of the Elks that did the barbecues out there on Tuesday night, and he said in all the barbecues that he saw one smoker the whole summer. So we created an ordinance here that wasn't it wasn't brought forward by the people of Atascadero. It was brought forward by bureaucracy, and we've created a situation that that is going to possibly take our police force, out there to settle a smoking dispute, so to please. And I would rather see them work on traffic control and that type of thing. I remember here a while back in a 4-year period, we lost like 4,000 or people in Iraq, soldiers, and in that same period, there was 26,000 young adults that were killed in automobile accidents. So it bothers me that our police are going to have to maybe go out on smoking calls. Now, as far as the zoo goes and the sunken gardens, I don't have a problem with that. But these other areas, it's kind of a ridiculous ordinance that's going to make lawbreakers out of everybody. So I hope we can bring it back and take a good look at it and make some adjustments to it. I know it's a feel-good thing, you know, and people say, well, why weren't the smokers here? Well, people that smoke are not necessarily proud of it. Excuse me just a minute, and I'll finish up. Are not necessarily proud of the fact that they smoke, and they're not going to come forward and say, hey, you know, I'm a smoker and I got my rights. So it needs to be looked at in 9 months or so. Thank you.
Let's try to keep our announcements brief. Anybody else have an announcement? I have a couple. We were just talking about water, so I thought I should bring up some of the water things going on in our community. Creek cleanup is October 3rd. That starts at the Colony House. The water company is putting on a garden festival October 10th. So those are some upcoming things that will be happening in our community. And the garden festival, I believe that's also at the Colony House. So those are my announcements. Committee reports. Mayor's Roundtable. I went to that last Friday, and the focus of the league at the moment is to get another ballot initiative on the November ballot to once again reestablish local control over our local taxes, tax money. And then after that, they're going to be looking at a constitutional convention that looks at local versus state control issues. And we will be hosting the mayor to support that, because the reason I voted for it in the first place was concerns about our youth. And I know in Stadium Park that there are youth that smoke up there illegally, and it would give grounds for the police department to enact something to help control that issue. In terms of smoking in Stadium Park, it was a paved area where the smoking area was. It's an old concrete pad that they used as a smoking area.
So you'd be okay with that then?
Well, it's already a paved area, so that's...
It's not paved, it's cement.
Well,
it's a cement. It's
whatever.
An old cement structure. Okay.
So but you're saying, I don't think we need to revisit it. I think we would have to gather some data whether it's affecting teenage smoking. I think that was one of the big issues for me and for many people in the public. And I disagree that it was brought forth by bureaucracy. There was many high schoolers who wanted to see this ordinance in place. So I disagree with that point.
Okay, well, I disagree with what you're saying.
Okay, we're just asking if there's consensus.
That's fine.
It's not a discussion. So, Councilmember O'Malley?
Well, I think you have the three to bring it back. I certainly had asked folks for input on this and would like to have... I wouldn't mind hearing from the police chief, see how that's gone with resource use, maybe the fire chief. I'd be a little concerned about smoking in Stadium Park more than any place else. But I would be open to considering designated smoking areas possibly, but I think I'm happy with the ordinance we put in place and would support it until I heard some need otherwise.
So there's consensus to bring it back. Are we talking in 9 months to a year, or when are we talking about doing that?
Something like that.
Okay, so
the city manager's
where?
Let's say 1 year.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine with me.
Okay.
Yeah, and again, not one person. The group incited the kids, and nobody come forward and said that secondhand smoke in open air was causing any problems. Nobody.
I would like to suggest on that, in addition to hearing how police resources, how this ordinance impacts that, I'd be more curious to see. I still have not heard any input from smokers, and I could understand maybe even if they wanted to speak, certainly talk to Jerry or any one of us individually or send something into the city clerk. If folks have some suggestions from smokers, again, that they see some suggestions on making this different, I'd be happy to hear from them. We haven't heard from anyone yet.
Could I comment on that?
I think we're suggesting we can hear from them in the future.
It's an addiction, folks, and smokers are not proud that they smoke. A few people smoke because they enjoy it, but most of them are not really proud that they smoke. It happens to be addiction. A lot of them get started in the service and so on, but it's legal, and 20% of the people
Kelly,
smoke.
Councilmember Kelly, do you have any reports?
Yes, I attended the Atascadero Youth Task Force and gave a presentation on the status of Colony Square, and it was attended by probably 30 kids up at the high school, and went over the entire project with them with the anticipation of having restaurants, retail shops, mixed-use housing, and brought them up the best I could to the status of the movie complex. Needless to say, they're all very excited and anxiously waiting for the opening of a theater in Atascadero.
And they're dying to spend all their parents' money there.
All that.
They got some pretty good deals on some property. It's going to actually impact their long-term operating costs. So I think I commend staff of both organizations. Further, the Regional Transportation Authority has taken over management of the transportation in-house rather than contracting out, and I think that transition has gone well. There is going to be an open house on October the 7th for the Council of Government, so you'd get a chance to take a look at this new site. I did want to comment a little bit on the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. I was appointed by the governor and do have enjoyed being on that board. It represents a six-county region, and my experience has been, much as we learned tonight on water issues, that often a preliminary study may come to a conclusion and you look a little closer and you realize that sometimes the recommendations are actually causing more harm than good. And I think it's important we have staff stay on top and look for accuracy, because we do want to take care of our environment. But I've been surprised how often first look you come up with a solution and it actually is counterproductive. And I think that's something to keep in mind. We're going forward. I've been very encouraged with the stormwater plan discussions at the regional board. I think staff has had a different viewpoint as cities have gotten more involved, and I feel that the regional board is working very well with cities on getting this plans implemented. And along those lines, I'd report that I think our staff has done a very good job. I have an opportunity to interact with our regional board staff quite often. I think we've done a good job of moving forward with our stormwater plan. There's also another option coming up, and I understand staff will be bringing that to our attention in another month or two. The regional water board has suggested, rather than going through individually with plans, that we maybe take a longer period and work together as a region and look at some of these plans. And they're suggesting a two-year period rather than a one-year period, some for us to consider. We're in a unique situation. I think we're making good progress, and we could probably go either way, but I think it's important for us to have those policy discussions. Similar to that, along those lines, is, as I mentioned, there's a low-impact design group out of our office in San Luis that has statewide recognition, and they're implementing some solutions that I think are really making an impact on water quality. And I think our city has done a good job in implementing a lot of these ideas. And as we had the opportunity to see one of our low-income housing projects, if you noticed how the parking lot area was there with good water retention in the sub instead of pavement, we had pavers with gravel underneath. We also just implemented a plan we got to get our picture taken with behind the high school. Very nice design, allows for, rather than water running off the street directly into the creek where you accumulate a lot of things from the road that can impact water quality, we're using that water to go off into almost a biofilter. Water is running off into landscape, which means it percolates through the ground and does some filtering out. And I think we in the city are doing a good job of implementing some of those techniques. And at some future point, I'd like our engineer to report on the seminar we've got to go to together. I and our two engineering staff went to participate with a number of other cities on looking at some of these design and discussion on stormwater plans.